Welcome to the Soulcast Season 2, Episode 1. Today's guest is Cindy Milstein. Cindy is a queer Jewish feminist, anarchist, author, organizer, agitator, educator, and world traveler, you know, among many things. I had Cindy on a couple years ago to talk about Rebellious Morning, and I wanted to have Cindy on today to talk about and expand on some of the themes that I've seen them talking about, whether it was on social media or at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, and sort of dive in on some of these ideas about scale and infrastructure and care and, I don't know, the quote-unquote softer side of anarchy, and how we can be better, how we can be the people that we want to see in the world. So yeah, this is an inspiring conversation to have at the beginning of a new year, even though, like, you know, it's all bullshit just on a calendar or whatever, but I like resetting the palette. It's a new year. Let's build some new shit. Let's think differently. But that's just me. So, as usual, I fund this project through Patreon. If you want to see it grow, I'm taking it weekly in 2020. And I fund this project through Patreon. And if you want to help fund it, you can go to patreon.com/SOLEONE. And as usual, this project is a proud member of the Channel Zero Podcast Network. And before we get into this interview, let's hear from some homies from the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
From Embers is a show produced about anarchist ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Every week we spend about an hour going in-depth about ideas, histories, and ongoing struggles that we think are important. We're a part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. You can check it all out at fromembers.libsyn.com.
In the eyes of the government, we are the enemy.
In a world where there is no government, anarchy rules. This summer, get ready for the most action-packed podcast.
We continue fighting because we hate all authority and love freedom, which cannot be given, but must be taken.
Such scenes as, "This is not a dialogue, a crime called freedom, party's over," and many, many more.
For more text and audio material of interest to anarchists,
check out resonanceaudiodistro.org.
Oh yeah, Cindy Milstein, welcome back to the Soulcast.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be back again.
Yeah, it's awesome. And, you know, Happy New Year. We're, we're recording this before the new year, but it'll come out after it. So this is like, you know, Brave New World podcast. So it's cool to start the year off with you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me again. Chat.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's, what's new? What are you working on these days?
I'm trying to stay human in these times and not despair. I think behind the scenes, I'm trying a little bit harder to do care and solidarity for folks facing state repression, and also just like experiencing forms of loss and grief. I just really feel committed to that. In front of the scenes, I'm another edited anthology that I'm doing called Deciding for Ourselves, The Promise of Direct Democracy, is just in the final layout stage and will be coming out on AK Press in April.
Cool.
And I'm also working on another anthology that will hopefully come out in the fall of 2002, called There Is Nothing So Whole as a Broken Heart, Mending the World as Jewish Anarchists. And I'm super appreciating the process of both of them. I'm being in contact with people all over the place talking about both sort of the beauty and possibility in their lives, and also the, you know, the hardship of maintaining ourselves in this world too. And and lastly, I'm helping to co-organize the fourth anarchist summer school that we do in Worcester, Massachusetts, called the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking, which will happen in August this coming year.
I love that. After going to some of your panels and stuff, I can imagine how cool it would be to, you know, to attend something like that. You know, you mentioned your upcoming book about anarchism and Judaism. I don't remember exactly what you said, but it makes me wonder. Like, do you find yourself like? I've been seeing a lot of like Jewish radical activism in the last couple of years, like an upsurge in it. And, mm-hmm. and like, I think that's interesting because it's like, on one hand, it's, or I guess if you could just speak to that, like, you know, do you think that that's like a response to anti-Semitism? Is that a response to like, you know, people like claiming their, whatever, their ancestry and heritage and like passing on the lessons from that and using that as a impetus for solidarity or, those are like the thoughts that came to me when you were talking about that.
I mean, even me wanting to do that anthology, looking at Jewish anarchists and what they're thinking and doing right now, and kind of why this new emergence, a renewed emergence of Jewish anarchists, because there's been a long tradition of Jewish anarchists and Jewish radicals and rebels throughout history. This is kind of a remarkable moment. I wander around a lot, and I think it was a couple years ago, I was noticing that when people would put me up who I didn't know, they seemed to I just kept running into more and more like anarchist Jews, either living together or organizing together, doing rituals together, learning Yiddish together. And I was like, huh, that's interesting, you know, as a phenomena. And it just spoke to me because I'm not religious, but being Jewish really shapes who I am, and being anarchist really shapes who I am. So I've just noticed, I don't know, I think it is in rise. It's kind of an opening was created. I think a lot of especially younger folks who are both Jewish and anarchist. And the third thing is often queer and feminist. That combination, I think a lot of them questioning sort of the structures in general Jews like to question that were handed to them, and including kind of an opening maybe of a new generation being like, we're tired of the last generation of, you know, or the generation above them of Jews being so tied to the state of Israel. So there was kind of an opening where people really wanted to break with this sort of Zionist outlook. The rise of anti-Semitism, the rise of fascism. I don't know. And I think the need that people are having now to find a sense of care and grounding and place in the world. And yeah, I don't know. I can't quite pinpoint it. So I think that's one reason I wanted to do that anthology. And I just put a call out kind of spur of the moment. I was reading zines because I personally was starting to do more getting together really regularly with other anarchist Jews who almost all are, again, queer and feminist. And doing organizing, but doing a lot of taking back of ritual space. So doing a lot of singing together. And I've just found the power in that, which I never understood before. But you get a group of people collectively together and you just start singing. And I don't really feel particularly good I'm a good singer or anything, but you get people together singing and there's this real sense of it resonates through your body, through your mind, through your heart, and you feel this kind of collective shared sense where you're creating something together, and it creates a sense of connectivity and community, and there's some real power to it that also just feels, I don't know, I don't usually like to use the word healing because I'm not sure we ever really heal from anything, but it definitely makes you feel more whole. And so there was a sense of, I think, a lot of people trying to reclaim and make their own spaces as anarchist Jews that also had this power around song or lighting candles or doing readings together and interpreting it. And I personally have learned a lot through the past year by trying, being like, oh, I want to put out a call for an anthology. I'm not even sure what I want it to be. And I got like over 70 contributions and many, many, many people emailing me who didn't even write. And I just really saw like this really profound, like so many people just said how meaningful it was to bring those categories together right now in order to grapple with what's happening in the world politically and also to stay human at the same time, that those two things really seem to be coming together. So, yeah, I just think it's really powerful. For me, it's been a super powerful experience to be around people who want to kind of interrogate not just the practices, but some of the like written traditions and written documents. And for me, it isn't an accident that a lot of Jews become anarchists or rebels. It's because of like going back thousands of years, the whole structure to Judaism is constantly documents that you reinterpret through sitting around together and arguing about them. And there's truth. It only comes from us reinterpreting and debating and how we practice things in the context of our own lives in the here and now. And that idea of the here and now being really important in Judaism to like, here's the world we have and we have to do, make it as good as we can. So yeah, long answer to be like, there's no one answer, but it's also just this beautiful sort of emergence. But I think we could say the same thing about a lot of other peoples are trying to sort of ground themselves through parts of their identity that have profound meaning right now. You know, I didn't go to Standing Rock, but I think why Standing Rock was so powerful for people who are indigenous was to be able to come together and also have that sense of regrounding themselves again in their own languages and traditions and cultures and connections with each other in a physical space. And maybe it's just that this time period in history, people, we need that more than ever.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because I used to be, you know, oriented towards like masses, like we all need to rise up together and, you know, da 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 da. But, you know, the anarchist says, or a lot of anarchists say, you can't really think that way because you're glazing over all these tensions. And one of the things I like about the work of the Invisible Committee, I don't know if you've read, have you read that stuff? The new, like To Our Friends?
Yeah. Yeah. I just actually listened to the whole thing on Resonance, the anarchist audio, which I really enjoyed it.
Well, I love that they do that. But one of the things I really like is like this idea of like that our times are fracturing, you know, and that the whole world is fracturing and like people are fracturing, like the world is like things are pushing apart. And so I think like if you go with that, there's like a lot of power in that, like no false unity, but this idea that like, you know, through our affinities, we can become stronger and act together across our differences more meaningfully. At least that's like how I'm thinking about these things.
I think the challenge is not to have, I also just listened to a really lovely, long, audio, zine series on that same website, called The Unquiet Dead. And that had such a profoundly good critique of essentialism and how that can lead toward authoritarian and fascistic forms of organization, including among anarchists. And so I really want to distinguish between essentialized identities and us reclaiming like the feelings of our past, you know, traditions and how we understand what's been passed along to us from our ancestors, including trauma and pain and beauty and connectivity and ways to unfracture, ways to create community, but in ways that allow us to not create borders between us finding those affinities. There was the Anarchist Summer School I'm part of has so many powerful moments in it. We just really strive hard. We don't have community agreements. We have sort of compass points of how to think about, you know, us together co-cultivating community for 8 days. What would that look like? And One of them is let's try to be the people we want to be in the kind of social organization and culture that we want for the next 8 days. Let's just pretend we're doing it. And people really, really do that. It's been really striking to me. But this past summer, one really beautiful moment for me is there were people there that had many different identities, which often could become essentialized and
I'm sorry. Can you please explain what you mean by essentialized? I'm not familiar with how you're using.
Yeah, essential,
this
term. Like there's some essential character to Jews that, makes me essentializing so that there's some pure form of identities and something that's always true for those identities.
All black people hate police.
Or all women are a certain way, or all women are which leads to transphobia when you think that, women are this pure category of something or have these specific gender characteristics, or only certain people can only be this way. And so when you start essentializing identities, it, creates this rigid wall that there's no ability for people to empathize between or be in solidarity with. Or so I really think when we talk about like the problems with identity politics, we should really be saying the problems with essentialized identities, as opposed to, people have things that are their identities that are meaningful to them.
Right.
And how do we do that in a way that's open and flexible and we find the interconnections? But also it is powerful when I get together with other anarchist Jews. For instance, we all kind of like a lot of us like to talk a lot and interrupt each other and have a different cultural mannerisms sometimes, and it's okay. Whereas when I get in other settings, that might not be okay. Or we understand certain, ways of joking about the world because that's how we've been, just shared things that come from a set of values or cultures. But that doesn't mean other people can't joke or other people, right? So,
right.
But I guess one thing that was really powerful to me this last summer was there was people from, different backgrounds that, indigenous and Jews and people of color and people without papers, that oftentimes when we look at sort of how we treat each other in movements, we will be like, well, the Jews aren't as bad off as, us because we've been here for this, or, the brown people aren't as bad off as black people, and all these other ways once we start essentializing, then we start creating this hierarchy of who's kind of worse off than each other. And at one point, a few of us sort of looked at each other and realized that, like, as we all come from this, it was a really powerful moment that I don't know how to articulate, but we're like, oh, we all come from this moment over 500 years ago in a place called Spain, where at almost the same moment, Silvia Federici's work has really looked at this. There was a witch hunts going on around Europe to kill off most of the women and the healers and queers and the trans people. And at that same moment, there was the Spanish Inquisition, which was trying to kill off or assimilate or displace the Jews. And at the same time, there was the move to send off explorers like Columbus to go conquer and colonize other continents. And that those all happened almost at the same time period. And so if we go back and go, wow, all of us who are, queer, female, diasporic, indigenous, Jewish, marginalized, othered, there was this moment in history where huge percentages of us were simultaneously displaced or killed or treated very violently. If we go back to that and say, it's been colonialism and capitalism and patriarchy that has created divides, I think we actually have more in common, in a sense of like, I think to expand on that, like to our friends thing, it isn't just our friends. It's our friends in a very large category is like all of us who are diasporic people have often much more in common in terms of enemies and in terms of what we want out of our lives and our aspirations than we do not, which doesn't mean that it isn't powerful for people who are indigenous to get together sometimes with each other, or Jewish anarchists to get together with each other, or, et cetera, et cetera. There's, but both have to happen, if that makes sense. I'm more thinking at this moment where you should go back to your fractured. I like that word. This fractured moment is how can we look at, you know, those of us who are violently hurt by those fractures, how can we share the pain of that and the sorrow of that and intellectually and emotionally examine where those fractures came from? And instead of turning on each other, is come together more to struggle together against those things that are fracturing us, but also to find the sense of love and care and community we need. And, you know, so I don't know. I keep coming back to this time period. I like for us to really take seriously what fascists all around the world are saying and who they're throwing together as who they think are the essentialized identities that they want to kill. It like that pretty much includes, you know, most of us who like the vast majority of humanity is in the categories that, right, that they hate. And to me, that just shows us, well, if that's who they hate, we all have a lot, you know, in common in terms of us trying to work together to out-organize them and crush them as structures. You know, so there's a sense of how do we do that, stay in solidarity, but we need these spaces to, I think maybe that's another reason why Jewish anarchists are coming together is, you know, the last week during Hanukkah, just in New York alone, around New York City, there was like over 10 attacks on Jews, and there's people still in critical condition who may die who are Jews. And, you know, there's so, you know, but we could look at Black communities and undocumented communities and indigenous communities and trans communities and disabled, all these other communities of people who are facing similar assaults right now. And, you know, and to be aware of each other's pain at these moments and say, wow, last week was the 8 days of Hanukkah. And during that time, you know, there was a dramatic, you know, uptick of assaults against Jews' bodies and Jewish spaces, Jewish graveyards, Jewish institutions. And let's think to reach out to our, you know, Jewish anarchist friends and see how they're doing. And when that happens to our Jewish, our anarchist Muslim friends, to reach out when that happens to our, you know, et cetera, we, to be aware of each other's pain. But it also, you know, it's been helpful this week for me to be in contact with other Jewish anarchists, because we obviously feel, you know, a specific sorrow at this moment.
What a sickening moment we're in. You know, it makes me sick. It makes me sick to my stomach to hear that laid out like that. It's fucked. Yeah. So one of the things you've been doing on, just moving on, another one of the things you've been doing a lot lately is this talk that I attended in Montreal that was very powerful for me, just seeing what was going down in the room, was this, you know, from another world is possible to the end of the world. And so I guess, like, without, you know, obviously it would take a long time to go through the whole thing, but I thought it was just a cool way to like encapsulate the anxiety and, I don't know, despair of our times. So I guess if you could just talk about that a little bit and sort of give me or tell me like what the feedback to that was like how, I mean, I remember in Montreal, like people were crying. I feel like I was almost crying, and just everyone, it was really powerful. And like one of the most, like for me, for some reason, I think it's because I really empathized with this person. They were talking about how, I think it was like they were doing anti-police stuff in Pittsburgh, and just like dealing with state repression. And like this person, I think they started crying, and they were talking about just like the stress of like not having elders to talk to in these moments when like you just feel like I've felt this before, like the gang, the cops are closing in on all your friends, and like, you know, there's no one to talk to, you know. And I just seeing that kind of space opened up was so like, it was so powerful to me, because I could feel in the room how other people were like it was just like I don't know, like you could just see people's brains firing off as like they're hearing all this. And so I guess, you know, thank you for that. I guess if you could speak to that.
Yeah. That panel was intended because it was the 20th anniversary of the Montreal Book Fair, and it was going to be the closing in on the 20th anniversary of sort of the ultra-globalization time period with that slogan, Another World is Possible. So the idea was, over the past 20 years, we've gone from Another World is Possible to now the possible end of the world. And my intent with that was I thought people would show up who had been around about almost 20 years, and we would have a conversation about sort of shifts we've seen and kind of strategize about what that means and sort of where to go. And I thought it would be more like a political conversation. And I was really as kind of beautifully and movingly taken aback as you were. I was really startled. I did the panel with two other folks, Aaron Lakoff and Shermin Khan. And Shermin has translated it, transcribed it, but it was recorded, and it's in Upping the Ante, this issue, some of our comments. But I don't think that captures at all what happened in that room. It was really, really full of people. And most of the people were far younger and had not been around for those 20 years. So I was totally not what I was expecting. And Aaron and Charmaine put out a lot of, I thought, really insightful shifts that I hadn't thought of. Like, both of them commented on the shift from people thinking globally and understanding how capitalism, for instance, was working across the globe. And now we barely understand how it's working where we live. You know, and another shift they pointed out to was the beautiful flowering of like DIY media that we relied upon 20 years ago. And now people rely on mostly corporate platforms. So they were doing analysis like that, which I was really appreciating. And then I wasn't planning to have it be so emotional. I think I've just done so many, created so many spaces for grief circles with the last anthology I did, Rebellious Morning, which I'm really committed to creating space for grief. But I just kind of had, in my 10 minutes, was trying to like kind of go, oh, here's some shifts we've seen. And so I just kind of really flippantly, not flippantly, but I didn't say it in an emotional way. I think I start off saying something like, oh, yeah, we've gone from a time when it felt like a lot more was possible to a time that feels like a lot of us feel despair. And then I just looked around like you did, and I just saw like all these people starting to tear up. And when I finished about 8 minutes later or so, the person you're speaking about is a person who I'm friends with, who's in their early 20s and is actually also a Jewish anarchist who's trans and lives in Pittsburgh and does a lot of organizing. And I think because they know me, they feel comfortable talking, but they were also tears were rolling down their face. And it really struck me too, because they were like, when you said that word despair, and then what they said that really moved me is they're like, I've been an anarchist. I'm paraphrasing them, but they were like, I've been an anarchist for a couple years, and all I've known is despair, you know, from comrades facing police repression to police murdering people to Tree of Life murders in Pittsburgh. And all I've known is despair. And we don't have anyone around who can tell us, how do you get through despair? How do you stay radical and you know, how do you do that? Because there aren't people. You know, and then so someone who said they were, I think, about 10 years older said, wow, I never thought of myself as an elder, but I have gone through cycles of despair. So, no, but what I was really struck by afterward, too, was so many people in that room just said, oh, that word despair. And then I was afterward at the book fair and in the week after, I ran into like a huge percentage of the people that had been in that workshop. And they just kept saying, when you said that word despair, like nobody actually is willing to just say it. And I don't think that's true, but on the other hand, I think we're so scared of just saying we're scared or we're depressed or we feel despair. And when you say them, they start losing their power because you realize you're not the only one. So long answer to that is, I think that I did that. I've done those spaces now 3 or 4 times, and they haven't really worked. Because I originally thought it was going to be a political talk, and no one ever shows up that's been around for 15 or 20 years, which also has illuminated for me that there aren't that many people around who've stuck around for a long time. And it's kind of broken my heart even more about that. But it has, the second thing it's illuminated is, you know, is just that what people really want to be talking about is how they're feeling right now. And from that feeling and knowing that they're not the only one and that they're not alone. So where do we go with that? So if you remember at the end of that, because most of that workshop was like an hour and a half of people sharing stories about how what they're thinking and feeling. And I remember toward the end, a person who looked young and self-identified as POC and queer just said, you know, the only thing they've known is they also were tearing up. And the only thing they've known is being in really, really toxic spaces. And they're like, ever since they become an anarchist, it's been like such a battle to stay in spaces because they're just treated so badly by other anarchists. And I think those two topics, like so many people have wanted to talk about in anarchist circles. So I think the whole concept of the workshop kind of was maybe not the right one. And to, in a way, what we need to sort of talk about is how do we think about a world in which we can name how we're feeling together and realize it's not us alone. And then how can we, for me, what's more interesting is how can we then let those feelings lose their power and understand together how we can try to, you know, out-organize the things that are collectively harming and hurting and destroying us, including within our own circles, which I think is it's really clear to me within anarchism. Sadly, I think there's been a real shift toward treating each other not as well as we could.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, if Scott Crowe were, you know, he would say he would blame a lot of that on like activism, you know, and I tend to agree that like, you know, a lot of like the horrible things the toxic shit I've experienced is more like the activist milieu maybe than like specifically an anarchist problem. Although anarchists maybe sometimes have their own way of doing that that can be, you know, a little more aggressive or whatever. But one of the things, like, well, first of all, with the stuff about, like, I think mentorship is like really important. So it's like cool that you're friends with that person and you can continue to, you know, because we all just need somebody to talk to. I remember, you know, like back in the day when I first got into shit, like, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm going to tell the ACLU on the cops and everything's going to be okay. You know what I mean? Like writing desperate emails to lawyers, like the lawyers are going to fucking get them, you know? And then it's like, no one. And then it's like, then I developed a really good friendship with Scott Crowe, and he is someone who has been, who really talks about like the emotional aspect of activism and burnout and trauma. And like, he was like really the first male identified person who really talked about like emotion. Like I've seen him like giving a talk and crying, and it's like, and I was like, man, that's somebody I want to know. But it's like, we just don't see a lot of that especially from men. It's like like when I was coming up in Denver, it was very macho. It was very much like literally, we got to be ready to fucking die for this shit. And I'm like, I don't want to fucking die over whether or not we take the streets. Like, that's not worth dying for. Sorry. You know, to me right now. But it's like this macho, you know, shit. And I feel like there's, you know, people like you and Carla Bergman and others are like trying to infuse a more, you know, whatever, affective, or making people think about like how these spaces make us feel. And so, yeah, so I guess I was just wondering if you could like speak to like, you know, what does it really mean to, you know, smash patriarchy and like, you know, finding new archetypes and new ways to express ourselves as radicals beyond, you know, the hyper militancy, which is great. You know, I love militancy. I think it's needed, you know. And another thing I liked is I said something similar about how like I'm tired of macho posturing. I just want to like link up with farmers and build systems of mutual aid. Like that feels good. That's what I want to do. That's the affinity I want to draw. And someone you came with came up to me afterwards and was like, you know what? It's not one thing or the other. Like you can do both. You know, you can be militant and you can be a happy-go-lucky farmer. And it's like, yes, you're right. I was wrong. But anyway, so yeah, I guess if you could just speak to you know, machismo and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's such so hard with language. Like
I know. As I'm saying macho. Word,
yeah. No. I was thinking with the word militant. Like, I feel like you can be, you know, people doing mutual aid after, you know, capitalist created climate catastrophes, let's say, that are doing mutual aid, can be doing it very militantly because they're going to be targeted by the police to be shut down, or, you know, you could have like a, you know, a collective, you know, food distribution or sharing food, and then the police are going to come shut it down, you know, and then you're defending it. And so I don't know. To me, militancy is in the context of, like, I hope we're all militant and that we're willing to, you know, try as hard as we can to, you know, defend the structures that we've created that are worth defending. But the flip side of that is we need to have structures that are worth defending and relationships that are worth defending and ourselves as human that are worth defending. And I think so much of in North America, sadly, is because of a bunch of forces way beyond us. You know, so many of our spaces and our even our own humanity has been taken from us in so many ways. So it often doesn't feel like we have much to defend. So I think part of the kind of rise of this kind of macho-y militant, you know, fronting as if you're doing something militant when, you know, you're standing in the street, that's not all that militant, you know, against cops that are going to, you know, attack you and you'll maybe end up in jail and maybe won't. That's not particularly interesting to me. You're not defending anything particularly. So I hope that we can have sort of like a tender militancy or some, I don't even know what the word would be, or Carla used joyful militancy with her co-author in that book of the title. But some way in which, you know, we have things. So for me, I think in Carla and I and other people and Scott who think prefiguratively, where we're like, what's really important to my mind is thinking about what we want and struggling to create those. So forms of direct action in which we're opening up what we want in this world, including ourselves, our hearts. And to my mind, that prefiguration is about breaking down all sorts of binaries, from gender binaries that destroy us all, to binaries that separate, you know, theory and action, that separate our mind from our bodies. So, you know, when people talk about, well, like, it's, you know, we need to get our emotions out just because it's good to have emotions. And I'm like, you know, I don't even understand how to separate emotions from actual material things that happen to us. So, you know, I've seen plenty of people get evicted from homes and they die within a week because how they feel about that eviction, how they feel about losing their home, how they feel not supported in that eviction can kill them. So, but alternatively, I've seen people that have been evicted that have had like a really good support network and people able to help them process the feelings and the grief of it and give them, you know, resources, but even just the emotional support, for instance, are able to be profoundly in pain and sad after they're evicted, but they won't die. So to me, the bringing the affective in isn't a separate thing from us fighting for a different kind of material world and a different kind of social structure. They're all interconnected. And we need to figure out, again, to come back to like what, sure, we should, to me, militancy is interesting when we look at the context and say, okay, what do we want to militantly shut down that is not allowing us to open up space to do what we want with our lives, to cultivate care, solidarity, love, spaces outside of private property relationships, growing food that's healthy and that we know where it came from, all these things, you know. And so, I mean, I think that's part, I don't really know what it means to smash patriarchy other than to try to bring in these values. To me, patriarchy's the structure that, you know, doesn't want us to see, you know, love and solidarity and care and the things that are seen as softer or tender or whatever. I don't even know what language to use here. It's like, you know, there's this very narrow framework of what fits in terms of what behaviors you can do. And I would add heteronormativity too, that like boxes into what, how we should be. And so I think we need to, you know, I think we need to, I'm just repeating myself. Okay. But I think the other thing that's been,
that's good pedagogy, right?
Yeah. But the other thing that's been hard for me within anarchism, I don't think we're any more toxic or more patriarchal or more awful than anyone else in society. I just think we come up with these ethics where we don't want to be this way. And a lot of people say they, you know, claim that they aren't, you know, so claim that we don't, within anarchism, for instance, have power structures that are patriarchal. And I would beg to differ. So I think, like Carla and myself, I'll just speak for myself. I think a lot of the reason that I've shifted toward really, really stressing care and affective and solidarity and, you know, really being vulnerable with each other. Like, I don't know how you can be militant if you're not vulnerable with each other, because you need to know what each other needs so you can go out and be stronger. And if you don't know that, you're going to put each other in danger. So for me, I think that's because I've experienced so much of the horrible power structure of patriarchy and heteronormativity within anarchist projects that I've been a part of. I've been kicked out of them. I've had to leave them. I've been hurt by them. I've been had my heart broken. And time again, you know, I wanted to talk about this, and I don't know how you do it, because to me, there's specific individuals that have been horrible to me. But I look at them and I go, you know, I don't think this is who they want to be. They've been socialized to be this way. I'm profoundly angry at them because their inability to self-reflect and to shift and to transform. So I'm not going to be around them. But I think they can be a different person if they ever wanted to do those things. But so to me, it pushed me back into doing two things. Is one is like, okay, I'm just going to keep working more and more with people that actually practice queer and feminist and non-binary and caring and loving relationships, not just put it down on a piece of paper. And that means that I feel like more and more I'm part of projects that actually do embody less patriarchy and less heteronormativity. But the second thing is, I think as anarchists, and I really think we need to interrogate in a loving, compassionate way, the power structure within the patriarchal sort of power structures within anarchism. And I'll use one example, which isn't meant as a critique, because I love your podcast and I love almost all the podcasts and anarchist media that's out there right now. But by and large, they are all almost, not all, but a huge percentage of them are, you know, cis male, heterosexual, for lack of a better word, people doing those media structure, not completely, but overwhelmingly they're, for lack of a better word, male. And it isn't that they're bad people or anything, but again, we are all, you know, socialized in certain ways. And I just think of some of the, you know, and there's very few power media, you know, media platforms that are anarchists right now. And I think we need a lot more that are, you know, less white, less male, less patriarchal, less heteronormative, just different voices. Not to say that the ones that are there should leave, because I think they're all great, but they in a certain way replicate. So the major sort of anarchist media right now tends to stress, for instance, moments of, you know, Christmas trees on fire, that get set on fire by anarchists, or people throwing, you know, bricks at things, or these moments that we would define as sort of the classically sort of machismo looking anarchism. And without talking about like, huh, I wonder how that, you know, why that brick was getting thrown, or what was the context, or is there a context? Does it make any sense? You know, was it in a good or bad context? Was it strategically smart? Who took care of people after they got arrested? How does, you know, all the other questions of care get left out, for instance? It's just this one visual of sort of riot porn, which, of course, it's beautiful to see such people standing up against police. I hate police. I hate the state. I hate prisons. and people fighting back and standing up there, those images are really powerful. But there's so many other images that are powerful, you know, like people growing food together, people doing mutual aid together, people healing together, you know. And why do those not get prioritized as images that we would show on the media? Or, you know, why do I do this myself? I try to post pictures of graffiti, and it's so prevalent to be able to find graffiti that's all the things we hate, but very hard to find the things that are about the values we hold. So why, you know, when you have a power structure that's already kind of thinking along certain ways that it's socialized, it limits what we even understand anarchism is, even though in reality, I know anarchism is much, much more diverse on the ground. The second problem to me with that sort of patriarchal power structure, and I've seen this personally in terms of some events I've been at, is that it's like this rush to get the news out. We need to be the first, and we need to scoop the story, and we need to have it out there, even if it's not accurate or we weren't there, and not actually reaching out to the people who are at the event and saying, do you guys want to write about it? Your collective organized it. What do you want to say about what happened? You know, and so kind of this like, we know better than you. And again, it's not horrible. It's just it replicates some of the power structures that limits the voices we hear and the myriad of beautiful parts of anarchism that we should be seeing that are there, that I know are there. And, you know, it and then it reinforces this idea for people coming into anarchism that this is what it means to be anarchist. And it's very narrow. So I've been just doing this silly experiment on my Instagram because I love taking photos of art and street art. And but I just started for some reason, I don't even know why it hit me. Someone had I'd run across a Circle A that was just really beautifully designed. And I just started doing this thing of like, let's make anarchism beautiful again and trying to use drawings or images or graffiti of Circle A's that are just really beautifully done that themselves are trying to embody different parts of what makes up anarchism to show that anarchism is about care and mutual aid and solidarity and, you know, non-hierarchy and love and seeding ideas and sharing and all these other things that I hope it's about. It's kind of just a silly experiment, but I've just been really struck by myself. I'm kind of enjoying it as a game for myself as to being like, how can we depict anarchism in ways that don't look the same to upend our own power structures of how we, you know, how we all think about it. It's a good thought experiment for myself to push myself to think past like, oh, what do I think anarchism is? Why is it beautiful? Why? How would we portray that in media? So
that's awesome. Well, as you were talking about that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to make a fucking a Circle A wreath, and I'm going to plant flowers in it, and it's going to be huge hanging off a tree in my yard. So I'll, you know, hopefully I can report. Yeah, I can report back at the end of the summer. And just
it's not even the Circle A, but I just think unthinkingly we get, you know, I just start thinking, oh, you know, people just unthinkingly just spray paint the same Circle A all the time. And then there's some people like designers who do art who've been like, oh, I want to make a Circle A that is about flowers, or I want to make a Circle A that shows different the kind of gifts we give each other. I want a Circle A with, you know, warm and fuzzy cats on it or whatever it is. You know, it's just like, how do we? Yeah. And so I think to get back to your other, how do we smash patriarchy? To me, it isn't this one thing. It's how we all think and how do we change that? How do we all behave and how do we change that? And, you know, I don't know how you do that on a large scale, but someone wrote me from Indonesia a couple weeks ago, this long, long, beautiful email with all these photos. And she said she was inspired by something I wrote, but also something other different anarchists had written. And it led her to be like, to say, oh, I want to work on the patriarchy where I live. And so she said, and I don't know how to do that on the large scale. So she started doing just creating space for people to have conversations together about how it hurts their relationships, hurts their structures, hurts their organizing. And she said, it's grown and more people tell other people about it. And then she kept showing me pictures of how many more people want to come. And it's, she said, yeah, at first it was people that mostly you would say, you know, looked or identify as female. And she goes, now it's not at all. Cause more and more people are like, oh, I've heard how caring it is and how wonderful. And it's really hard. And she goes, sometimes it's really uncomfortable and scary and people feel angry or hurt but she goes, but more and more people keep coming back. And she's like, I don't know if this will change the world, but she goes, it might change how anarchism is where I am. that just really moved me. Like, you know, like, I don't know. Unfortunately, sometimes we have to kind of go back to, sometimes it's going to take more generations than just us. And I think that's maybe why, to go back to that, why I wanted to reflect back on 20 years. And I realized, wow, there's so few of us that have even been around 20 years. That's really absurd. You know, there should be multi-generational spaces where we're mentoring each other across experiences. I feel like I learned just as much from someone who's 8 or 18 or 28, because we all have different experiences. But if we had that, you know, I think we would see that it's this, we're hoping to pass on things. We're not like going to change patriarchy overnight, but we might start seeing like, oh, if we had a, you know, what would we want to see in 20 years from now? I think that's another interesting thought experiment. And how are each of us going to try in our own ways, in our own places, to try harder to break apart patriarchy or heteronormativity or racism or, you know, all the other things that create hierarchical power structures within our own circles. Much right. Less the world. For, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just to dovetail off of your white man comment, I just had a couple anecdotes. And one of them is like, you know, I was there with one of the people who helped start the Channel Zero Network. And like, you know, one of the first things I was like, look, I don't just want a bunch of fucking white dudes. You know, how do we like not have a bunch of fucking white dudes? And like, it's just like, I think in our society, you know, the people who feel like the most encouraged to talk are fucking white dudes, as anybody who's been to an assembly knows that for a fact. And then when you look at like the sort of media and the sort of, like, you know, what, like the sort of books and like, you know, the sort of stuff that people are exposed to, again, it like reifies, patriarchy, you know, like, radical publishers can put out a million books that are, you know, that show a wide range of, you know, class, gender, and racial identities. But what catches the zeitgeist? What do people latch onto? Usually, it's the stuff that exemplifies the sort of politics that we're talking about. The hyper macho, for a lack of a better word. And I can see that changing, but I guess like just in closing to all that, you know, anyone who's listening to this, who wants to try to start a podcast or start a podcast, the Channel Zero Podcast Network is always welcoming to new people who are interested in creating podcasts and putting them out. You know, we bring people into the projects, with consensus. And so if people propose projects, we talk about them, and bring them in. And so if there are people who are on the fence that are listening, you know, queer, trans, BIPOC, like whatever your identity is, you know, you can hit me up and I will gladly take it to the project if that's what you want. My email address is SOLE@SOLEONE.org. So I don't know if you have people who are on the fence. Like I've wanted you to do it, but you have so much going on. If there's anything I can do to help address that, I am very open and would love to help. So,
yeah, no, I just actually want to thank you. I think you've been, one of the rare examples of someone who's I find has been really encouraging to wanting to see other voices. And I think when you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, it isn't, again, this isn't a critique of individuals. It's just as, let's say, as a, for lack of a better word, movement or circle or whatever we are as anarchists, I don't even know. like, I think it's a profound commitment to, like, Channel Zero, I love, is this idea that if we consolidate a lot of different podcasts into one place, people go there and they go, oh, you know, I know about Soulcast, but I didn't know about, you know, The Final Straw. Huh, listen to that. Or I didn't know about, you know, this. And it's a way that people can find other podcasts. But so, that, you know, it creates an infrastructure for that. But then there's all these other things that structurally, like over time, is like by and large, certain people, you know, grow up. It isn't just too you know, I'm a talker. It isn't just who's, you know, feels comfortable talking and who feels like their voice will be heard. It's who feels comfortable taking shit when they say things. I get a lot of shit and I have a pretty thick skin. And that shouldn't be how it is, that if you put ideas out in the anarchist world, you have to be mostly worried about getting shit. That is a structural barrier. Another structural barrier is skills. You know, a lot of certain people grew up learning how to do techie things and getting reinforced in that, and other people don't. You know, I keep having this idea, I want to do some kind of pod thing, but I'm not good at the tech stuff, right? So, but I'm not alone in that. And another is, I think the last thing I just want to say is a commitment within our circles to share, to do some more skill shares. Like we used to do that. And, you know, it'd be really cool to see, like, once a year, there used to be like much more once a year, both the Allied Media Conference, which I don't think is doing this quite as much, and Z Magazine, I know, used to do this, and a few other groups, is like once a year there'd be a place where people could go and learn how to make media, like the technical skills of how to make media. And so I think what it's come down to is like, oh, there's some like big anarchist publishers and big anarchist, you know, networks and big anarchist podcasts. And they don't spend time also organizing the spaces to pass along the skills and the knowledge so other people can do what they do. Because they get, you know, to some degree social capital, or they're just too busy, or also a host of other reasons. Not that just, I'm not saying people are, it's some horrible thing. People are just doing this because they're bad. But I think to some degree, you know, there's social capital, there's overwork, there's all these other reasons too. But again, if I was going to bring in feminist values, I say, hey, we need to be spreading out knowledge. We need to be spreading out resources. We need to be spreading out skills. You know, some of the big anarchist media could use some of their funds to seed other media projects, you know, if that's what it is one of the barriers. So just some ideas. But I just think partially it's us sitting down and going, okay, if we're really, really committed to breaking the power structures within anarchism, let's not start just saying this person, that person, but going, what are the, without making people feel bad about being part of that, you know, power structure. Because I publish on AK Press. There's very few anarchist publishers. You know, I love publishing on AK Press, but there should be 50 anarchist publishers, not two or three, right? And so how do we do that? You know, but you need, you know, how would we really look at how to diversify that? And I know, like AK, for instance, I know I've been really committed to this. When I see someone giving a talk or doing some piece of writing that's not, you know, for lack of a better, you know, a white male anarchist academic, I will be like, hey, have you thought of publishing that? Why don't you contact AK? I've been trying much harder to direct or go to PM Press or go to this other publisher. I personally have been committed to trying to encourage, you know, but each of us needs to do that. Well, and as a movement, we need. And
I will take this all to heart and think about it a lot. And I mean, just, you know, Channel Zero is like something that runs on E. You know, we raised $1,000 3 years Whoa. Ago, and we're still 3 years ago, and we're still running off of that. Like, there's you know, it's all volunteer. Like, there, you know, the, and you can imagine, like,
oh yeah,
you know, how like what it's like trying to get things done, and like we're still, like, you know, reevaluating and trying to, you know, reimagine the project and sort of relaunch it next year. And so I'm really glad you've sort of raised these things. I know, like, that was one of the big things that Burst was on when we started. It was like, we need to be creating resources on how to make a podcast. Yep. And I was like sitting there like, how to make a, but if, you know, I've been making music for my whole life. I've been around electronic recording software, and I know how to compress and EQ and all, like, all this stuff that's second nature to me. I just assume, like, anybody with a phone knows how to do that, but it's like, that's stupid. You know, I was wrong. Like, Bursts was right. We should have, you know, and, but the thing is, it's never too late. So, there's a, you know, within the problem lies the solution. And, there are, you know, all things are addressable.
Yeah. No, that would be really cool. I mean, I think that's part of why, like, the Anarchist Summer School I'm part of is, you know, like, a small group of us are like, you know, we can't do everything, but we feel the lack of certain things within anarchism. So we're going to create this 8 days to try to bring those things into anarchism. And it's one small thing. And out of that, we recently brainstormed, it would be so cool to have all these other weekend workshops. And one of them, for instance, was on, like, hands-on media, you know? And so even if it was a weekend, within the next year, one weekend where, you know, low budget, I mean, the way we finance the Anarchist Summer School is we do it at a 25-year-old collective house. So we have a free space basically that's subsidized by people's rent. then we just do a sliding scale of 200, which covers the cost of food. And that's pretty much all we put money into, and, you know, miscellaneous, but it's not like any, you know, and then we just do a sliding scale. So we're like, if you pay zero, if you can pay 300, you'll pay for someone else. And so far each year we've broken even, we haven't made any money, and we haven't lost any money. but, you know, that's just one model. But, I just think even if it was a weekend long, you know, I just think more and more we need to be like, you know, even one of the people with Channel Zero Network sat down with me because for 4 hours one time graciously and just was like, okay, I'm going to go through step by step. If you wanted to produce a podcast, what would it take? I knew nothing about any of it, you know, and someday maybe I'll go back to my list and you know, I even thought about that. Like, even if that time that person spent with me was a zine on here's the steps, because I didn't even understand how many steps there were. For instance. So anyway, you know, just all these different ideas. I think it's not to just lay it at the media, but that was just one example to me of, you know, where we can sometimes see sort of a tendency to where that, you know, militant machismo is in the visual images that come out of the media, or who tends to write books and who tends to produce podcasts. And again, a lot of them are really good. And I actually love Channel Zero because of what it's trying to bring out in the world.
Okay, fine. Stop dumping on white guys. God. No,
I'm not an essentialist, so it's not white guys as a category. It's we want to just encourage more beautiful production, not less of what's already happening.
This is why I wanted to talk to you, because I'm trying to make my podcast more succinct, but I really want to like flesh out these more nuanced ideas and, just get people thinking differently, you know?
I wish we did this thing at the Anarchist Summer School last year where we're going to do it again this year. Anyone that had come to the 8-day program could come back to like an, quote, I don't know, alum gathering. But last year, which we did last year for the first time for 4 days, we don't publicize it because you have to have come to the other one. But we literally for 4 days did these exercises in how to think strategically. And because we all sort of already knew each other, it was so far beyond what I thought. We not only we went so far beyond that we were like thinking about like this time, like how do we, and I think we think strategically, but we kind of go, oh yeah, this is what we do, or this is what, how we've done it. But we don't kind of sit down and kind of evaluate, you know, like we did a sort of exercise and sort of, you know, what's happened within anarchism over the last 30 years? What are the tendencies? What are the theories of social change? What have been the barriers? What have been the, you know, beautiful breakthroughs? And what resources do we have? What do we need? And we did all this thing at the end. It was so powerful to come out with like, wow, it was so clear where strategically it seemed like we should go out of it. And I just think we need to do more of that. You know, so your podcast is a great, like this concept of like, okay, what would it actually mean to, you know, not just kind of like smash patriarchy. That's a nice concept. Fine. It sounds great. But what does it actually mean? Like on the micro, how would we actually even begin to do that? You know? And I think we don't spend enough time, you know, doing that, especially now when we're up against such serious shit. I think we need to spend a lot more time strategizing. Okay. How would we actually counter fascism? How would we reduce the number of prisons? You know, like what does that look like? Not just kind of continuing to do the same things we always do. Which clearly isn't getting us right now. Clearly we're losing ground, not gaining. So,
right. Yeah. We accuse liberals of wishful thinking and not, I try to not use the word, throw the word liberal around, but we accuse, you know, people who, you know, are all about Democrats or whatever as wishful thinking, but like can't recognize it within ourselves, you know? And that kind of brings me to like another big, this one's a doozy. Some of my best friends think about revolution as if our goal should be to rise to the scale of our enemies through mass movements, because that's the only way to win, in quotations. I believe we're in this moment where without masses rising up, shit is going to be really fucked up. But my involvement with mass movements has sort of made me lose faith in their ability to confront the issues we face in the States, just for a number of reasons. People are alienated, you know, just a million reasons. And I don't even know what winning would look like anymore. And so I just like, but you had tweeted something recently where you were talking, where you said something like, I don't remember exactly what it was, something about like rising to the scale of our enemy, or we don't need to rise to the scale of empire, to confront it or whatever. Can you sort of speak to this issue of like scale when we're thinking about, you know, strategic thinking just how anarchists can envision a future or struggle or whatever.
And I feel extremely inspired by the fact that around the world right now, there are like incredible, large scale, really diverse, really imaginative and inventive and confusing and complicated movements in so many places right now. Like Hong Kong, you know, and for us to reduce them to having these stupid debates, are they anarchist enough? Are they not? Are they fascist? Are they liberal? Are they this? Or, you know, the Yellowjacket, all these other things, they're very diverse and complicated movements, but they're large scale and they're long lasting. And you can't just make those happen out of thin air. So it's really hard being in North America or the place called the United States specifically, where when huge percentages of the world are rising up and also facing profound repression, which we are too, that you don't see that kind of like collective resistance as much in the United States. And that's perplexing and saddening. I think we face, like, you know, I don't know. I've just been, you know, there's so many, that's a longer conversation. What are all the reasons for that here? But, you know, you go almost every other place and I still think people haven't had kicked out of them this idea that you can resist, you know, even if it's going to be hard and you're not going to potentially win, you try. You know?
And, well, can I just cut you off really quick and just throw something in? Again, I bring up Scott Crow just because he put me up on your work and he's like a, I don't know. I just really love that guy.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he said to me that I thought was really interesting was how at this moment in history, this is the first time where, you know, most people live thousands of miles away from their families that they were born in. And so, like, you know, although we can have adopted families and adopted communities, at the end of the day, you know, when you are taken, like, that's why I feel like a certain power being back here in Maine. But anyway, like, just this idea that, like, when we're not, like, emotionally rooted to the things around us, like, if, you know, I was watching a video on Hong Kong, and they were talking about how, like, you could just see, like, these workers and these just normal everyday people there who were, like, you know, protecting the kids who were throwing rocks, and, like, you know, they saw all the stuff going on and they didn't even shrug at it because, like, they were all, like, these people are from here. We are all in this together. Whereas, like, people in the United States don't feel that. And again, that was just like a Netflix or Amazon Prime documentary or something I was watching. It doesn't, you know, glaze stuff over. But I think that, like, the fact that we're so alienated and so unrooted, disrooted, I think that plays a huge role in it. Anyway, I didn't mean to, like, cut you off. I just earlier that, you know, it's your cultural heritage involves cutting people off. So I thought I'd
cut me off. No, I completely agree with you. I saw something that said the people in the so-called United States move more often than almost any other place in the world because of, like, rents and lack of family structures, lack of support, blah, blah, blah. So so many reasons. But so anyway, to back to your, to me, it's less a question of should we organize on this mass level? Like, if there isn't a mass level, I think there's, like, certain leftists or Marxists or, you know, some anarchists that, et cetera, within whatever the broader radical milieu, that have this idea, we only need to focus on mass organization. But to me, that, again, has come back to your wishful thinking. It's like, sure, if there was, you know, but you, so, and none of us can create these moments. Like, it's almost like I don't know, that book that's going to come out soon, Deciding for Ourselves, that I did, it's people wrote long pieces about 8 or 10 different places right now that some, I hope they all last by the time the book comes out, where people have been able to carve out, like, long-term or large-scale zones of sort of autonomy to self-govern and self-determine. And, you know, you can't just snap your fingers and make that happen, right? You know, so in almost all the pieces, they talk about the context too. But it reminded me that, like, when those moments come, like, we have to have more infrastructure and, you know, ahead of time, all the pieces that people wrote for that anthology, for instance, emphasize that there was already a culture of sort of solidarity. There was already some sort of practices of how to make decisions. There were already, you know, spaces that they didn't start from nothing. And so, to my mind, instead of thinking about should this be at the mass scale, we have to be like, okay, how can we build whatever capacity we each think we need in the here and now? And, you know, if I think that's media and education, that's what I'll work on. If someone else thinks it's, you know, food and healthcare, that's what they should work on. If they, you know, then when this moment happens where inexplicably some gigantic movement starts up, which has happened in North America, you can't predict, that we're more prepared, you know. So what's happening in, you know, I don't know, I'm no expert at all on what's happening in Chile, but I was in communication for the last couple of years with a person who is there, and they were going to write a piece for this anthology, but ended up not doing it. But they kept talking about the, like, years of work that's gone into, like, sort of feminist organizing there. And I remember them going a few months ago before what's happening in Chile. Now they were like, I don't even know what's going to come out of this, you know? And now look what's coming out, you know, Chilean feminists have did that song against toxic rape culture that has become picked up like wildfire around the globe. And people have done that same song where they live and, you know, changed it to their local context. I was in Greece for 5 weeks recently, and some young Greek woman said, "Oh, do you want to come to this assembly?" Everything they do, they call an assembly. They go, "Do you want to come to this assembly with us? We're going to learn this dance." And I hadn't even heard of it yet. And so I went there, and there were 50 of them in the room, and they were all learning the dance from Chile, and they were debating how to cover their eyes with that black strip that the feminists in Chile use. And they were debating whether to use something from their own culture or something from Chile. And they decided to use something from their own culture because they're like, no, because this speaks to the patriarchy where we are. And then one of them turned to me because they were translating it all to me. And one of them said, "We've never had 50 women in the same room together. You don't understand how patriarchy is here. We never organize just with ourselves." And I was just like, okay, you know, there's this gigantic movement in Chile that we could say is this great mass movement that we wish was happening in this small town I was in on Crete. But there are 50 women in that room in that town in Crete, and they felt a sense of connectivity and power, and we're doing something different. So is it an either or even? It isn't to me. So to me, it's organizing again, what you're doing, you're in a place, you feel whatever that place is. If for me, I guess I don't feel place in terms of being grounded in a location. I feel grounded in sort of a community and ideals and ethics. But whatever that place is that speaks to each of us, we need to organize from that place.
Right on. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's like the difference between like mutual aid and charity kind of, you know, it's like a lot of times things get called mutual aid, but it looks a lot like charity. Whereas like, what does mutual aid actually look like where people are helping each other? Because like, it's not just favors for favors. It's the cultures that we can create, the bonds, the escaping capitalism. I mean, there's so many things we can do, and I'm so happy to hear you say that about struggle and infrastructure, because I can remember when I was in Denver, we had P&L printing there. And although there was like a lot of like problematic stuff that went down with that place, and I never got too involved there because I didn't like the culture of the place, to be honest. That said, having that sort of infrastructure there where, you know, we had like, we could go there and meet, you know, we did like, there was a lot of incredible stuff that happened just because you had a co-op where a whole bunch of anarchists were working together. And like, I feel like I benefited from that infrastructure. And like when things like Occupy or Black Lives Matter would pop off, we'd have like that extra added, like capacity. You know, even if like some of the people behind it were pretty toxic, like there was still that capacity there. And when it was gone, you know, because of the way that power was centralized there, like the anarchist movement there took years and years to recover. And so it's like when we create these spaces, they have to be egalitarian, or as you would say, democratically controlled, or they have to be power structures that don't, replicate the shit we don't want. Especially because, you know, when things like that happen, it's like, but that said, you know, I feel like, you know, because of like certain tendencies that we see now, there is also this critique of infrastructure as like a trap. And so how do we do, I don't know if you have thoughts on like when we're thinking about infrastructure, social spaces or other more abstract forms of infrastructure, how can we think about, you know, approaching them in ways that, that aren't a trap, that aren't like wishful thinking in itself, you know, to keep those things linked up with actual struggles. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's maybe back to your question, like also question about like, I mean, you know, fascists are talking to each other and organizing across borders with each other and are reinforcing and helping each other. And how do we do that in a way that's non-hierarchical to me is the question. It's because we do need to not just organize for ourselves as anarchists. I mean, that seems to me kind of meaningless. It's like, so how do we, you know, do projects that are speaking to all of us who are facing the risks of what's happening in terms of like fascism and ecocide right now, and love and take care of each other. And but how do we do that in ways that have different kinds of models with them? So part of it is coming up with, like, whenever we do something, are we building infrastructure for its own sake, or are we doing infrastructure that's dynamic and flexible, can change when it needs to, is there to serve a purpose, and when the purpose is gone, we birth it well and we let it die well. I've been part of a lot of anarchist projects that it was so clear they needed anarchist infrastructure that they needed to end. So how do you end them well, you know, and not just keep them going because it's your identity or, you know, your social capital or all these other things. So, you know, and that takes us trying to keep each other honest. And it also is us trying to think of infrastructure to put in place when we build infrastructure. Years ago, when I was based in Vermont, thought I would be based there for the whole of my life. I was part of a radical bookstore. It wasn't a moneymaker. It was like a book project. Yeah, sort of like we sold books to pay the rent, but we didn't. There were sliding scales, so we weren't making any money. So, but we always had this thing that we wanted to start it well, and we wanted to end it well. And the most important thing was maintaining social relationships with each other in our collective and maintaining social relationships in the community. But every 6 months we would sit down and evaluate whether we were meeting our own goals. And when we weren't, we would end the project. And we actually did that. After about 5 years, we weren't doing what it was supposed to, and we ended it well and passed along the resources to other groups to encourage them to build capacity and to build infrastructure. So, you know, to me, it's a balance of building infrastructure that isn't just for the sake of itself, but, and that also means we have to be people that are willing to be honest and open and vulnerable and self-reflective. And, you know, again, some of the feminist values that we bring in, not just like, I'm going to do this project no matter what. Like, no, well, is it still, you know, like you were talking about getting together with Channel Zero, and you all are hopefully rethinking. I think that's really healthy to we're doing that with the Anarchist Summer School. So we're kind of rethinking what we've been doing for the past 3 years. And should we do that again next summer? You know, how would we change it? You know, but that also takes a level of being really brave, right? Because you have to call into question yourselves and but that said, I think anarchists are, especially in North America, are so woefully inadequately focused on infrastructure. And so I really hope that I've been, you know, really inspired by the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief network that rose up. And this is just my understanding it was a small number of people that had the idea and had done that kind of work for a long time and decided to organize, and they're still doing it. They go around and they've done, you know, workshops for 1 or 2 days in hundreds of communities to try to encourage other people to figure out the infrastructure they need where they live for mutual aid when disasters occur. And for them, disaster is fascism and, you know, ecocide and a host of other things. But they're not trying to create a centralized infrastructure of one place that you call. What they're trying to encourage is that wherever you live, you figure out what you can do in your community to have infrastructure for mutual aid during disasters. And I know that the groups that have kind of come together out of that project, out of necessity, have had completely different structures and goals and contexts because they're not having to check in with some centralized, national body or something there. But at the same time, there's a sense of solidarity between them. So when there was hurricanes that happened, you know, that were striking Puerto Rico and Southern Florida and other places, they had enough social relationships and interconnection and relationships that they could form a temporary network between a whole bunch of cities over, you know, thousands of miles to bring resources, you know, thousands of miles to where it was needed. But then it dissolved afterward, after that, the initial crisis, right? So how do we think about that? You know, I've been really, one of the tactics I really liked of Hong Kong, I've used this a lot, but I just really love it, is when they need something at the, you know, when people are up against the police in the front line where they're nose to nose with the police, is having a string of people back to where the supplies are. And each, so when someone at the front line said, oh, well, we need more, you know, tear gas masks, let's say, they pass it along back down this line, and the people that are way far away from the police and the danger and can send the masks up to the front. And if you didn't have the people in all parts of that line, you would have nothing. But to me, how do we think about infrastructure that way, that we're like this, you know, interconnected chain that can help each other when we're needed, but we have different roles. But if we're not all there, we're not going to make it. And so I think we need to be thinking about more. If we don't, you know, we need to be more anarchist health clinics, anarchistic healthcare clinics. I know there are anarchists that are organizing to do that, you know, more, you know, places that provide food, that provide housing, that provide, you know, mental health, that provide all the things we need in the world. Meeting spaces, everything, media production, you know, we just need more and more of that infrastructure. We just, again, I think we, you know, we have an abundance. That's one thing we did at this, at the Anarchist Summer School, at our sort of alumni gathering, is we actually went through what kind of infrastructure we have. And we have a lot of some types of infrastructure, like media. We have relatively a lot, but we have almost none of others. You know, how many anarchistic health clinics do we have? Very few. And people need healthcare right now desperately in North America.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's also like, just to dovetail off what you were saying, I kind of feel like, you know, like the learning the road through walking and like, you know, projects, you learn their utility if they're actually used or not, you know? And so if you have something that works a couple times and it doesn't work, you stop doing it. Like the example that comes to mind is like with Channel Zero, originally it had like this like automated player in it that was like, that we had to like manually upload it and tag it. And it was a fucking, it was a pain in the ass. Oh, and like, I would get so irritated because like, you know, people wouldn't upload their stuff and so it wouldn't be on the player. And then like after like, but then no one would listen to the player unless we linked to it. You know what I mean? And so then like at a certain point we were like, wait a second, if no one listens to it, unless we're blasting it on social media and people are really just going to the website and like clicking through and like listening to what's the interesting to them. And like the website runs automatically. Why are we stressing out over this fucking thing no one's using and we don't care about? Like, okay, problem solved. Get rid of the player. That's $450 we don't have to come up with every year too. Bam, bam, you know. So it's, you know, just to bring it back to the conversation about Channel Zero, like, yeah, like no one was using it, but people used the website and we didn't even expect that. I didn't expect that to be a thing. So not to, you know, bring it back, but it's like, yeah, we can, you know, it's also like, you know, to know when something, when it's a good time to call it quits. Sometimes it's like, it's scary to say, you know, it's time to end this. But then like when you end it, and you don't regret it, you're like, oh shit, that feels good. I feel a weight removed from my shoulder. Now I'm having other ideas, you know? And so hopefully like, you know, we're learning as we go from our mistakes and, you know, learning the road as we walk.
Yeah. I think the problem is, again, language is like, when we hear the word infrastructure, we think of like bureaucracy and state institution, all these things that are just like live on well beyond their, if they ever had a purpose. Or our infrastructure sounds violent, you know, often our infrastructures of violence. And for us to really think through, okay, how would we do this differently so it doesn't end up replicating all the things we don't like when we hear that word, you know? And so part of that is, it's like, I really do think, I don't know, like, how do we build our capacity when we end things? How do we end it so that we're building our capacity? And I was also, like, the last 2.5 years or so, well, when folks were arrested at Trump's hopefully one and only inauguration, what became J20, I and a small core of us, about 8 of us, ended up being a finance and fundraising working group for 2.5 years. And, you know, a lot of people raised money, but as our group, to cover all the J20 defendants, I think we raised like $150,000, the kindness of all thousands and thousands of people and organizations. And we made sure all the defendants had what they needed until they did not have charges. And, you know, in terms of legal defense, so lawyers or places to stay when they had to go to court and transportation to court, et cetera. But when it ended, we ended up having, you know, like, I don't know, $40,000 left. And I was really proud of my working group. We're like, okay, how can we use this to build capacity for other people doing anti-repression work? And we ended up, you know, by asking a bunch of people, drawing up a list of a whole bunch of groups, and we end up giving that money away to, I think, to 30 or so other groups that were currently facing state repression on large, you know, and doing really good anti-repression work, and sharing it forward to build our capacity to deal with state repression. Because for us, it's like the reason we were raising money was to build our capacity to get people not to have to go to prison, to, you know, to not let the state let new forms of repression work. And we felt like we succeeded. And then we wanted to pass that along to have other people be able to do that. And, you know, we still need to write up something to explain that to people publicly, which I keep wanting to do, because I think it's a beautiful example. But everything we end, you know, that working group is basically at its end. We don't need to stay together. But I just want us to think more about when we build things that are infrastructure for specific time periods, even if it's like 3 years, when we end it, how can we think of coming out of it in a way that makes more than we went into it with, which most institutions don't think about that. They just keep going until they collapse or die or implode or everybody hates each other.
It's like my friend Chris from Unicorn Riot says, a collective is successful if it replicates itself. And, you know, I mean, he was whatever, fucking 10 years younger than me, whatever he was saying. I was like, God, you're like only 21 years old. How are you so smart?
I love Unicorn Riot. They do great coverage of also some of the, I would encourage people to watch some of the things they really also focus on, like projects that where people are doing like solid. They've done a lot of series on solidarity work, how people support each other and care for each other. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. It's cool that they, spread it out. I'm sure we need it all. We need people on the front lines for the crazy shit.
Yeah, we need
people covering the other stuff. We've pretty much covered a lot of what I wanted, all of what I wanted to talk about and more. And, you know, I, really appreciate you coming on, but before I go, I always like to just ask what, I don't know if you have a book you're geeking out on or a book that you recommend, that you think is a good book to read right now. It could be Harry Potter. It doesn't matter.
Oh my goodness.
As long as it's not a John Grisham novel, like you're not allowed to,
I was trying to, I feel like my brain didn't find reading time because I do too much, editing for, my paid work. And also because I'm doing anthologies right now, but, I have really been appreciating, sort of utopian feministy science fiction things whose titles I can't remember that friends have been recommending, because I think the world's really hard right now and it's good to like try to remember that there's other ways of imagining the world.
Like Starhawk or something, or like what are you?
No, I read that a long time ago. I can't even think of the names. And I've also really want to shout out, I think I'm reading a lot, in the past 6 months or so I've been reading a lot more zines, which I'm appreciating, in terms of just have been sparking my imagination, including zines by Jewish anarchists I've been really enjoying. And again, I've been listening to things like anarchistic books on tape, which I feel like my brain is being destroyed, like all of ours, by like a society where everything moves too fast in social media. So, but I also have been appreciating listening to books. So like I said, I think that Unquiet Dead I totally loved. And I listened to Our Friends, which I loved. And I have started listening to Letters from Insurgents, which I've enjoyed, but I have just a little bit into that. So I would suggest Anarchist Podcast, fiction on books. So that's kind of a sampler And
Letters
of
Insurgents is great, by the way.
I started reading. I got to get back. It's so long. It's like 50 hours. So I have to find – it's more when I'm like, okay, you know. Going from one place to another, I've been trying to listen to, and I guess two pieces that I actually do really want to highly recommend that are both, short, Saida Hartman's, The Anarchy of Colored Girls Assembled in a Riotous Manner, I think is super provocative. It's beautiful. And it's a super provocative way to, it's a, you know, telling story of history across the grain and through the lens of people who are suffering the pain of this world, the pain of, you know, racism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and how do we think about telling different stories? So I love that piece. The other piece that I also like is, trying to remember the title because I'm terrible at titles. I'm just trying to find it really quickly. And it's also on Resonance to be listened to. It's called Skin in the Game. It's an audio zine. And it looks at, and it's just because I'm interested in this topic, but it's also really good if we're interested in fighting white supremacy. It looks at the role of anti-Semitic thinking within fascism and why if we don't actually contest that type of thought, we won't actually be able to contest the way white supremacy works in the United States. And it's written by someone who's a longtime black radical who's done a lot of anti-racist and anti-fascist work. So those two things I've really, really liked recently.
That's awesome. Yeah, especially I'm really I really want to engage more on this podcast with like new zines, like just because well, I guess a lot of books is just redundant, really. Like, people just repeat themselves a lot. And it's like, you know what? Like, you can usually make – a lot of times you can make your point in 30 pages. And some people are just making awesome zines and just writing great stuff. And I want to
– Yeah. Yeah. No, so I would encourage people. I think I agree, too. I think maybe it's because I edit books for a living on not radical presses. And, you know, they could all be an essay pretty much. And then you're like, oh, okay. So I think I'm appreciating reading like really tight arguments. And actually one last piece, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's, if you look at the tower, which is a lovely, lovely space in Hamilton, Ontario, and they're facing a lot of repression, the folks there. So support them. But they put out a piece that I can't remember the name of, but it's looking at machismo within anti-fascist organizing. And it looks like where it emerged historically, but it looks at how it impacts our radical circles too, not just fascist circles, and distinguishes between the difference between patriarchy, misogyny, different types of sort of thinking. And then it also at the end starts talking about what would a feminist anti-fascism look like. And I think it's such a good conversation piece, like read it in a group and then go beyond where it goes. But it's a really lovely, that's a really lovely piece. And it is available, I think, on Sprout Distro as well, or you can order it from the tower. Okay, so the title of the scene, which I would highly recommend, it's called Anti-Fascism Beyond Machismo, Gender, Politics, and the Struggle Against Fascism. And if you Google anti-fascism beyond machismo, or like Google, forget Google. You just do a nice different kind of search engine for anti-fascism beyond machismo.
If you duck,
yeah. you can find a zine-imposed version of it, or you can order it. But again, it's a really, really good piece to have a conversation and also to look within ourselves and say, wow, how do we end up unintentionally replicating some really problematic, ways of thinking that could lead us to machismo behaviors that we don't want to do. So it's a really lovely piece in that way.
That's awesome. Those sound great. Yeah. We, one of the things that we do out here is I have some comrades and we do a reading group and just once a month, you know, just, and it's like just using a book as, just for conversation. Like we don't have to like, we're not in college, you know? And, but the first book we picked was like 400 pages long and no one finished it. And then we're like, no, let's do like Inhabit next, or let's do something really. And so I love the idea of getting more zines that we can talk about, because really it's more about like, you know, the kind of conversations that, we can have.
I think study groups, the only study groups that ever seem to work that I've been into, I love study groups, are ones where it's short readings. Cause I don't know, people just after a while, like, oh my God, suddenly you're like two of you reading the book.
Yeah, and it's homework. It's like, oh my God, my kid, I'm exhausted. I've been cleaning diapers all day. I don't feel like sitting here for an hour and a half reading 900 pages before Sunday. So, hey, Cindy, before we go, over the years you have expressed some interest in doing a podcast, but because you're not like, you don't really have the time to be doing all the editing and all that stuff, or even the technical ability to like want to learn that stuff. And I don't blame you. But there are a lot of people out there listening who, might want to help you with that. So if you wanted to kind of explain like this potential idea you had and see if there was an energy out there to work on it, what was your concept?
Oh, sure. I keep going back and forth on this, but I sort of had this idea of trying to do a podzine, which would be a little rougher than maybe it doesn't have to be that polished, but I'm not technically able to even make it a rough podzine. We're just sort of short little, I would tell short little stories or anecdotes about different like examples of really inspiring prefigurative things I've seen or little things that are annoying me in the world or whatever. Maybe, you know, 10 minutes long or 20 minutes and just really irregularly when, you know, just kind of recording something. So if anyone feels like they have the technical skills and wants to chat with me about trying to produce that, where I could just ramble into a recorder for 10 minutes or so and send it to you, and I could make it into a pretty rough little podzine, that would be great. In the same way that a lot of people have written sort of zines that are collections of lots of little stories. That's sort of my idea. And over time, there'd be little batches on them that would, yeah, be out there in the world. So it's just an idea, and I can try it. And if it doesn't work, I can stop. But if anyone feels like producing that and trying the experiment with me for a little bit, feel free to get in touch with me. My email is cbmilstein@yahoo or Rise Up.
Oh, it's the same at Yahoo and Rise Up?
Yeah, I don't check Rise Up very often, but I should use Rise Up more. So
awesome. Yeah, yeah. Again, not to put you on the spot or anything. It just like the concept sounded cool, and there isn't enough of that kind of audio zine stuff out there, and especially your voice, I think people should be hearing more of. So yeah, well, yeah, I hope you're listening, I know there's a lot of audio geeks out there, here's an opportunity to work on an incredible project that yeah. All right, well, we're at an hour and a half. It's always a good time to say goodbye. If people want to support your work, what's the best way to find Cindy Milstein on that amazing and beautiful thing that we call the internet?
I wish the platform was ours, but anyway, I tend to post a lot on Instagram with little picture essays a lot, which I like that kind of genre. And, but mostly I hope people will, look at some of the books I've done. Mostly I love editing collections of other people's voices. So, yeah, look on PM Press. I have one on Utopian Practices in the Here and Now with Eric Roon that I did. But then on AK Press, there's including a new works coming out. But don't support me. Let's all support each other.
There you go. And that's a good way to end it. Awesome. Hey. Didn't raise no snitch.
We'll all be captains then.